when you're working inside of a really big organization, your product isn't the same as a consumer product,
That's
right?
true.
Bringing a consumer product to market is easy. You can identify really easily who your customers are. You can set really clear metrics. You can focus on, outcomes. You can measure those outcomes. And it's really easy to be like, your ROI is super clear. It's crispy, right? We sell a thing, we spend an amount to build the thing, we sell it for a certain amount. We need to sell X number of units to cover our costs.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast. It's our pleasure to introduce to you Emilia Breton-Lake. She's a very well-known speaker in the Agile circles, and we'll let her introduce herself in more detail.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. I'm Emilia Breton-Lake. I'm a playful agilist. And one of the things that I really adore doing is bringing play into teams while we tackle some of the really wicked problems that we face as agilists. Currently, I'm working with a wonderful startup, VSCO, Visual Supply Company, as their director of program management. And really diving into helping the team there, figure out how do we deliver wonderful products to all of our creators.
That sounds exciting. Emilia, you and I go way back when. I think the first
Yeah.
time we met was at IC Agile Bootcamp.
Yeah, back in 2016.
It's been a while. And I've always seen you as something innovative going on with you every time. And then the games that you had put together, and that's been pretty exciting.
Yeah, I love working with teams and working with games because it's really, I mean, once you get people into this place where they're playing, one, you learn so much about each other that you wouldn't have seen. Right? Because it creates like this really interesting sort of view into all of the things that happen often when like the coach isn't in the room. You can see how do people react and how do they shift when they're in really stressful situations. Who are the quieter members? Who are the people that sort of silently support from the sidelines? Who are the people who step forward? It's always really interesting to learn from the people who are playing. And the folks who together are playing, they have this opportunity to kind of experiment with new concepts and learn. And because it's a playful environment, the like stakes really lower. And we let a lot of the trappings that we carry around every day about how we're supposed to react, how we should do things, a lot of the layers of protection, that kind of thing, they just sort of fall away.
And what I've seen is like maybe first for 5 minutes people are little, and then they open up, and
Yeah.
then they really start enjoying and then focusing on some of the games, I guess, central idea, and then just it just they don't want to end.
Yeah, it was one, they're wonderful.
And you find that people are more creative after they play games?
Yeah, it sets this tone. First of all, it's like the cheat code to psychological safety often because it just brings everybody in and then be in this place, you become playful, and then that like idea pump is a little bit primed, and nobody's afraid of looking silly. Nobody's afraid of coming up with the dumb idea. Kind of started the fire.
Totally, totally.
Very
And then
nice.
I think the other thing is what I've noticed is people get a little more creative or more adventurous. They want to take little risks that they wouldn't usually take and go into the areas that are little known or unknown to them. So that's a really good interface for them to like, yeah, I can open this up.
Yeah, it's because it's just a game, right? You're not risking your job. You're not putting yourself out there in a way that you might make a mistake that impacts your product, that you might say or do the wrong thing because it's a totally safe game environment. So you can kind of experiment and try things out.
This is great. I'm sure our audience by this point must think that we're going to talk about games, but that wasn't the original intent. So why don't we switch to your other favorite topic?
Yeah, well, so it actually plays into a lot of stuff around product. So, for example, right now I'm really working through, the startup that I'm working at. We're coming up to another quarter, and we're coming into the time when we start thinking about what is the next set of work that we should do, and looking at building, our 6, 12, and beyond sort of roadmap, and then really refining the items. What will we do next quarter, right? Those things that are closer in the roadmap. And I've been working on, designing this great workshop that we're going to do. I'm also bringing some of these same things in at a global Scrum gathering in New
Ooh.
Orleans next month.
Yeah.
But games are very much a part of it because in product, often you have, sort of two groups of people, I think. You have your idea fountains, which are there's always an idea in all of the things. And sometimes they need a place to make it safe to let go of some of those things. And then you have, the folks that are a little bit more thoughtful that need some more time to warm up. And I found that there's sort of some sets of games and things that really get that stage started. So, for example, in this workshop, one of the first things I'm going to start out with is a game from that comes out of the design thinking world, called Crazy Eights, which is basically you just draw a set of problems and then slowly refine the best ones, right? Until you have sort of, okay, here's where we should focus, through rounds of combining people's ideas, et cetera. And it gets the ideas kind of flowing, but then also gets that collaboration going and it primes the pump thinking about what's the most important problem to solve. What are the most important things that we can focus on in this fun environment where you're just talking about drawing things? So it makes it safe. It also builds that muscle of what do we say no to, which is so hard often for folks to really like bring in that focus to figure out. What are the couple of problems that we're really going to focus on solving for our customers now?
Yeah, funny you should say that because I think we used to play something similar, wedding planning game, and it was very similar idea about what is the crux of it? Two people and a maybe a priest, and that's all is needed as the first part that has to everything else, depending upon the situation, this one can come later, or if not, that's okay too, kind of thing. So yeah, I can see that there could be 20 different ideas for getting what wedding wants, and then really is only two people and a priest, and that's it.
Yeah. And it's really
Yeah.
about coming together and like getting that focus. Because it's so difficult if you're part of a product organization that doesn't have focus. We've all seen those companies where everybody's spread so thin, where they're just putting out product after product after product, maybe that don't necessarily make sense together.
Yeah, it's like, when they say minimum viable product, there is nothing minimum in there. It's
Yes.
just everything but kitchen sink goes in.
Exactly.
Like the wedding with 500 people, seven orchestras, 12
Yeah,
courses. Hey, that's a
and they don't
typical
necessarily
small
all
Indian
fit
wedding. Yes.
together. And they don't have a cohesive flow, right? So that's what we're really looking for is to narrow in. Also, when we're trying to actually build the thing, right? We've planned it and now we have to build it. If we don't have focus, you don't ever get to done. Or what you put out are just this sort of shotgun of different things.
And I think also the other aspect of it is how do you get the feedback loop into that? Because the sooner you start getting to that feedback loop, the focus will provide you that quick path to the first feedback, and then it'll start building on the top of that. But if you have scattered everything, then what do you get the feedback on? And how do you know it's converging to a solution?
Yeah, completely. And sometimes it's really useful to get the feedback before you even get to that point. Another one of the product owner games that I love, that I talk about and I use a lot, came from Luke Homan, which is Postcard from the Future. And there's something really powerful about enlisting some of your best, closest customers and asking them to write a postcard from the future, talking about how they're using your product and what things they're doing with it and what problems it's solved from you. Because that's just like an open book, right? They're giving you what they want for the next things in a very creative way.
True. And I think that's the other aspect of it, is that what is their expectations is that gets outlined. And now you have a like an endpoint, what they're looking for, and then you can solve that. So it's giving them that thought process as to how does it look like a year from now, 2 years from now, and then we can start working backwards.
Yeah, and I use it too inside, like when you have a really early stage product and you're trying to craft that product vision and figure out your lighthouse. So you can take these from your customers that inform it, but then as a product manager, you can really kind of take it and write your own. And it helps you. Because you're using sort of this creative outlet, you're creating a picture, you're creating what is the feeling and what is the essence of the thing that you want. And then, really, that written part that gives you the sort of articulation and the most important things. And it's a postcard, it's small. You can't write too much, you can't go too far. You have to focus.
Yeah, I think that's the key, in the sense that it's not a novel.
Yeah.
You have to condense it to, and then it forces them to think small, think concise, and convey it to the within that, 8 by or whatever, 8 by 4 or something like that, which is really interesting. Because when we are talking about this, those statements that you are saying, those are going to be our acceptance criteria, because that's what is going to tell me what you're looking for. And did we meet that or no? Yes or no, kind of thing. So yeah, I like that idea of having a postcard from the future. It has narrowed down the concepts, what they're looking for, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So do you have any thoughts on how to handle very large organizations where there are ecosystems of products and multiple product managers who have a certain vision for their part, and it is a product in its own right, and yet it has to, work with all these other products?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I've done this work in places as small as Visco, but even at Visco, we have six product managers. Each who owns their own area of the product and all have their own sort of ideas. But previously, I worked for, one of the world's largest banks. When we were talking about just in the one area in which I worked, we had thousands of teams. And that just was just one portion of this large bank that had a bunch of different lines of business that had their own teams of teams and their own. We call them product and agility offices, right? And there, a lot of the very same things worked. It was just a matter of taking this smaller group of interconnected teams, and they're doing this work. And then this other smaller group of interconnected teams, and you have coaches within those, and then bringing them up, right? And bringing them together, and then bringing them up and bringing them together into, separate value streams and portfolios. So you have smaller groups working together. You can take many of the same tactics, but you're working with sort of who is the lead of this portfolio, this portfolio, this portfolio. So what are your visions and how do we bring them together to really build up to this overall, what is our direction? And it really sparked some wonderful conversations. So one of my partners there, Simon and I, did a workshop that was basically the leads of different lines of business. And it was about what are the most important problems to solve right now as we look forward into the world of cloud and AI? What are the opportunities that we have that we might be able to bring this into the world? We're talking about, I think, the cloud transformation for that organization has been going on for at least a decade. So how do we like focus and bring it forward and get to done and understand what are all of the pieces and all of the pieces of software that have to be moved off these old, monoliths and into the cloud.
So interesting. So it was a bottoms-up approach. So was the sort of overall vision or business strategy formulated based on that, or was that given as an input to sort of provide some guardrails?
It kind of went both directions. So there was a mandate coming down from sort of our senior managing directors, and a direction and a line of strategy, but it was very, very open. And there's a lot of blanks to fill in between, move to cloud but for 2027 and actually do the work. And what does that mean? And what are the pieces to get there? And what are the right groupings to get there? And who do we need to have involved? Because you have to have the right people on the boat with you to do the work.
Yeah, basically the enablers will understand where the beginning and the end of each phase or each unit is, and then what's going to take and who's going to take to get that. Yeah, I can see that. That totally makes sense. I'm curious to understand is how do you know? How did in any of the product migration or product journey, how was that conceived that, okay, well, this quarter we got this done? Is that, how did that get built and the incremental part of it? How did that work?
Well, so the way that we actually opened doing a lot of that work was going back and leaning into, sort of the older bowels of lean. And we did some value stream mapping, not value stream mapping quite the way you do it in SAFe, but, good old fashioned, what are the things we're doing? How long do these various tasks take? What's going on? And really looking at the process that had been being used, optimizing that process and building the agility into it. And then, okay, now we've identified who the right people in the room are, getting those people in the room, getting aligned with each other, getting aligned on what needs to go first, then as far as like our systems, and getting aligned on, okay, who all do we need in order to move this next, this first most important thing? Because they're not necessarily the same people as the second most important thing. You're dealing with really large organizations.
Absolutely.
Because the first thing and the second thing, and then what can we do in parallel? Because they're actually totally different groups of humans. And what things do we need to synchronize? And one of the things we ran into that was a little bit surprising was the, and how do we actually make space for doing this work beyond the run the business work?
You hit it on the head. Because most of the teams will have those, net new stuff, keep the lights on stuff, and then there is the escalation stuff. So you need to be aware of that and then make sure that we have accommodated all those things. I see that.
And that was really some of the difficulties there. Particularly because when you're working inside of a really big organization, your product isn't the same as a consumer product,
That's
right?
true.
Bringing a consumer product to market is easy. You can identify really easily who your customers are. You can set really clear metrics. You can focus on, outcomes. You can measure those outcomes. And it's really easy to be like, your ROI is super clear. It's crispy, right? We sell a thing. We spend an amount to build the thing. We sell it for a certain amount. We need to sell X number of units to cover our costs. Whereas internal products are a lot more difficult because can figure out kind of how much they cost you, but not really, because it's often the side of the desk work. And how do you show value of this versus that? Maybe it's cost savings, maybe it's time savings that gets a little more squishy, but it's not nearly as easy to measure, which means that your feedback loops are softer. They're there.
One of my mentors had mentioned, especially that internal kind of products, is that we are building the product so that you guys can make money. Because we are the ones who are enablers for your whatever that you do. And then you can look at it as to what the bigger business case may be different. But our internal business case is different. So, the scales, the P&L, all those things are a lot, as you said, squishy. You don't have a direct draw. Yeah, totally. I can see that. And we experience that even at even as in a mid-sized company, we run into that.
Are you sure you were not in listening into the meetings I was in today at work?
Positive. But I think it's a universal problem, right? We all
Yes.
like, how do, and then how do we measure the impact that this thing done internally had? And was it this thing that gave you the boost? Or was it some other thing? Was it just that people got better at performing X? Or there's so many factors, it becomes really squishy. It's like with agile coaching, right? How do we determine the value that we as coaches have? It's squishy. One of my partners actually at work the other day said, I don't actually understand exactly what you do, but I know that when you're in the meeting, it works better.
Yeah. Well, there is a big discussion about Agile Coach as a product, and that's really what is it coming down to is to, how do you quantify coaching, even the Scrum Masters as a product? And then as you said, the internal products are basically exactly that it is built-in value, but these are the enabler products. The coaching is also enablers. It's what we do is like either lead from behind or just being coach at the end. So if you look at those three phases, different values get delivered at different point, and over the time that really shows whether what the value was. So you cannot just put some dollars around there.
Yeah, it's a lot harder. Some of the ways I've been working through that is by again leaning into that product box and looking at things like, okay, what can I measure and what will they pay me for? Nobody's ever going to pay you to be agile or to implement Scrum or to do Safe or to launch less or any of these things. What they want is, how do we deliver better products to our customers faster so that they will pay us?
Right.
They'll be more satisfied, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think the what you just said is exactly as to, a lot of things when they start owning it and they run with it, they're like, oh, this is common sense. I'm like, is it? How come you didn't know that about before I said something or I started working with you guys? So the common sense is not as common as you think, is it?
The way that I've been sort of approaching some things here is to take and then make those metrics very visible. So we can look at how were things a year ago, and looking at a couple of key things. First of all, flow metrics, right? Cycle time, throughput, lead time, and how have we changed over time on that? And then looking at some stuff that's a little more like I added a question to our survey that goes out from HR every quarter that was, how connected do you feel to the goals of your team, right? So that we really were looking at, do people understand how the work that they're doing rolls up into achieving the goals and the outcomes that we're looking at as an organization?
Funny you should say that. I mean, as Steve was saying, you must have been in some of our meetings because it is really it's universal that everyone, if you go down to the team level and ask that question as to, do you know if you what you just wrote, how does that roll up and what does that serve? Almost more than 70% will say, I don't know, I was just told to do this. And having that relationship or having that sense of what is it really we are doing to get that and why and what's of that, the whole, I guess, approach changes. The product gets better, the outcomes get better, the morale changes, everything changes.
Yeah, because you know what you are contributing as an individual to this greater goal.
Exactly.
And
And the
if
new
you have
ideas start coming in from the bottom up.
Oh
Because
yeah.
now they know what will change if we need to make that.
Oh yeah. So we had a hackathon, and we had so a hackathon, everybody proposes what is their project, and then we call upon people to join their project. So basically, I want to do this thing, who will join me in it? And we had one engineer who had 20 projects that he had conceived of. It's important to know that my organization is about 100 people. They did not all make it through. They didn't all find, you know, enthusiastic partners to build. But the best ones did. And that was sort of the wisdom of the group. But it's through really developing and working on that, having everybody know the goals and aligned on the goals. We talk about how we're doing and what our goals are and how we're tracking toward them every month. And it comes into our all hands, and it comes into a group of our leadership team. And we're regularly reflecting on those. And then as leaders, we take that information back to our team. And that's part of our responsibility to get them aligned. And then everything we do has a goal. So we have sprint goals. Epics have benefit hypothesis of what outcomes they're going to build, both for our creators and for our business. We have, you know, every story has a why behind it that leads
Nice.
Into being able
Right.
to. And that's been some of the huge changes that we've made in the last 2 years that I've been here.
Yeah, but you know, you said the key word, why.
Yes.
You know, most of the time, people are told what to do and never given them why we are doing that. Once you get that why defined, or at least outlined, people can relate to it. Then they know how to. They are the, you know, the craftsman. They know how to get it done. But why is normally missing. And that's the sign of command and control. Just do as I say. Well, don't ask why. And if you actually provide that why, I think I've seen that. Yeah, but you said it exactly right. That why is needed. And I'm so glad to hear that you are actually, even the story has a why, which is nice.
Yes, everything has a why. I believe really deeply, you know, it's probably very cliche right now. Simon Sinek, start with why.
Yeah.
And we do that with everything, is we start with the why. It's only by starting with the why, then you can figure out the what,
mm-hmm.
and then you can figure out the how.
That's how the breakdown structure works from that. And especially when you are, what I've seen is, if the vision is given into that, and then the subsequent roadmaps or whatever, those are the subparts of miniature wise coming
exactly.
Through. What does that mean to each of the contributors or the other organizations that are going to be working with them, and why we are doing it? Interesting, when we are talking to the product owners or product managers, they always are a little bit saying, why are you asking me to say why? I said, well, think about what you'll get back if they don't understand why. And they see it, if that's the feedback loops, and so sometimes they tell, oh, wow, we didn't even think that they were thinking in that direction. And maybe I wasn't clear.
Yeah, when I was a product manager, I would tell people what I was expecting, the sort of the what and the why, you know, let program deal with the who and the when, and engineering with the how. But I would often explain what my, you know, epics or user stories were about, and then have them reflect back. And I would always focus on the why. Why are we doing this again? And if they didn't get that, I would just like really drill down and make sure they understood it.
Yeah. One of the things we've started working into our process over maybe the last month is we get great, for years, we've had wonderful creators come in and talk to our teams. We do it at least once a month. And then every quarter we have somebody come live with us so that we stay close to those customers. And we've started working into our stories and our epics, really referring to some of those customers who've come in and done sessions with us. So for example, we had a wonderful creator who was using a different tool. So she would take her picture, bring it into another tool, erase things, and then bring it in and do the rest of her editing in our tool. And her name is Meredith. So we were working on, as we're working on projects that are about workflow and about various different pieces of that workflow, different filters, different pieces, getting that perfect shot, making the collage of those shots. We'll refer, when we work on those things, we'll say, you know, for Meredith, we want to do this work,
nice.
Bringing in the actual real life people.
Hmm.
And that practice previous to the last month or so, it was always for our creators or as a creator, I want, right? And we've started saying, no, actually, as this real live human, not a persona that we used with an empathy map, but this real human who uses our app every day to create art, what does she need? What does she want? And we have a number of those.
I love that.
Yeah, you know, interesting you say that because we have started something very similar, something called as a day in the life of. So the actual consumer or the end user, they come and say what they do when they come into work and when they start using the products and how they use it, what are their constraints, what are they are happy about, and what they would really like to see something solved. And now, and then we showed them to the development teams, and some of them are in India. So they for the first time realize how their real end users are using it. And it just changed the whole perspective of why they were doing this. And immediately within like 3 months, the quality of the ideas and how even just those smaller stories that were getting built and how it just completely changed. It's like, and they started talking about that person's name instead of saying this particular customer. So yeah, they can relate to it. They can see the person working and doing things, which is really the crux of it.
I also remember as a product manager, we were building an internal application and we had agents, and I would just sit with the agents and do a ride along and just really observe how they were working. And it was amazing. There were some revelations about issues that were recurring that were really easily solved. But just that ability to really watch a person do their work is phenomenally useful.
It goes back so far into, the origins of agility, right? When it was brand new, and we were talking about mostly, extreme programming and the on-site customer and the bringing the people you're building it for closer and closer to you. I think it's really, really useful and powerful. I don't think there's a substitute for it.
Yeah, you know that the Joy Inc. that book and from Menlo Ventures. I think I forget the gentleman's name, but what they said was they actually had their customer run the demo and show the teams how they actually use it, and then they realized that oh, here is the reason why that OK button is so difficult to find. Just to, when they saw how they were using, what their reaction was, what they were looking for, the ease of use or difficulty of use, everything. But it really changed how people think of solving the conversion of the solution, and the product really became more customer centric, which I thought, that's the connectivity.
Our wonderful leader asks us all, first of all, we all use our app. But beyond that is talk to our creators. He has a challenge of like, whenever there's a decision to be made, go talk to five creators. We have a wonderful UXR team who does studies, et cetera. But no, you as a product manager, just go ask five creators that question.
Nice.
And it's his regular challenge. And I think it's really smart and impactful.
Totally.
So, any suggestions for what to do, for example, in like consumer electronics, where it's difficult to have that relationship? You're selling through a chain of stores. The customer's kind of remote. They buy the product. You don't really, I mean, yes, you might be able to capture some metrics about how they use the product, but it's a little bit of a different world compared with what you're describing. So, how would you handle getting that feedback from users?
I think some of it is, especially if it's a large scale product like that, talk to five people who are in the group of people who buy your thing. If it's, say, an Xbox, go to Best Buy and stand in the Xbox aisle, or, the video game aisle. You'll find five people within a couple of hours, or go online to Reddit or any of the other wonderful things, and find people who live in that area, not in that area of interest, right? On the internet. It's not like it was, years ago. There are people that are passionate about just about everything, and you can find that community and ask people.
One of the things I've done is look at reviews of similar products online, see what people like and don't like about them.
And look at your own reviews. This is something that I'm surprised how often, particularly organizations who build applications like us, the Apple Store, the Google Play Store, they give you a gift. You can see exactly what people don't like about your product. Sometimes you get the few that like something, and articulate exactly what it is that they love. Your positive reviews tend to be, loved it. It's great. It ha you know, but if you read your critical reviews, you can really see where are my holes and what are the things that we need to address. They tend to be far more specific than your good reviews.
Oh yes.
Yeah. I mean, the ones who are going to be critical, they have done their homework, and that's the reason why they are actually responding in that fashion. So yeah, totally. And I think what I've also seen is that you can start looking at, say, if you go to 10 or 15 of those one-star reviews, you will start getting a theme, a common threads around there, saying that, oh, okay, well, there are multiple people, multiple that there is something going on here. So yeah, it gives you the next idea of where the improvements need to be and what it really makes a difference to them. So yeah, I totally agree that one or two star reviews are your best way to next improvement. We used to, the one place I used to work with, we had to listen, not contribute, but listen to the customer service calls and what the complaints were or how they were responding and what kind of frustration or happiness, whatever that is, that they were coming back in. And that really told us how our product was working or not working.
Another place that I love is Reddit. You can go to r/anything. And if you're in a larger organization or company, r/your name, and you'll likely find people talking about your product, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And they don't pull punches. You get realness.
Nice. So one thing, if you want to encapsulate all this product launch or product, even if somebody's thinking of product, what would be a common theme that you would say, well, if you are thinking of a product, start with these three things.
Start with why, your customer, and a dream, a vision.
That's so true. That is you nailed it in the sense that if these three things, we can start even putting it down on a paper. It is the concept. That is the concept. Steve, any further thoughts?
No, I think this was great. I think we went kind of a, I'm not going to say a full circle, but we covered a lot of topics. I'm glad that we came back, and that was a great question, Santosh, to sort of wrap up this conversation.
Thank you both so much for your time.
Yeah, thank
Well,
you.
thank you. That
Yeah,
was.
making time for us to talk to us. And a few more, as soon as our reactions and things starts coming back, we'll make sure that we'll forward you those.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Take
Thank
care.
you.
See you
Okay.
next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.